Start your day with Morning Edition and wind it down with All Things Considered, only on KPBS. From global headlines to local stories, stay informed, inspired, and connected. Tune in daily or listen anytime at kpbs.org.
It's time for KPBS Midday Edition. On today's show, expanded jail oversight, avocado production, and whether you call it Cowles or Coles Mountain, we're talking about the history. I'm Jade Hindman with conversations that keep you informed, inspired, and make you think. Healthcare workers and contractors will now be investigated after a jail death. Then, while everyone loves avocados, producing them may be a challenge in San Diego County. We'll tell you about what that means. Plus, the history of what most people call Cowles Mountain. That's ahead on Midday Edition. Yesterday, the County Board of Supervisors voted to expand the authority of the Civilian Jail Oversight Board. You may have heard it called CLERB. Well, now this civilian panel can also investigate jail health care workers and contractors after someone dies in custody. Investigative reporter Kelly Davis explains it all in her recent article published yesterday in the San Diego Union-Tribune, and she joins us live. Kelly, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Jade. Thanks for having me.
It's always good to have you here. So break it down for us. What happened in yesterday's Board of Supervisors vote?
So basically, this was a kind of long time in the works plan to, as you mentioned, expand CLERB's jurisdiction so that they can now investigate medical and mental health providers when someone dies in custody. And this was brought forth by Supervisor Monica Montgomery Stepp. And so what they'll now be able to look at, and this isn't retroactive, it will apply to any death that happens. There's going to be one more vote to kind of finalize things at the end of the month. So then after that, this will take effect. And so anyone who dies in custody, CLERB investigators will be able to look at things like, did the person get timely treatment? Did they get their necessary medication? We've seen instances where people die after not receiving heart medication or insulin, or they weren't put on the jail's drug and alcohol withdrawal protocol and they died from dehydration. And we only know these things because their families have filed lawsuits. And CLERB, since it was formed three decades ago, has not been allowed to look at medical records when they investigate in custody deaths. They've only been allowed to look at actions by sworn staff, by deputies. And so now this was like the important first step pending a final vote to, like you said, give them the authority to investigate in custody deaths. Medical actions by medical staff. Yeah.
Well, and I want to make sure I'm clear on this. So they will not be able to go back and look at previous cases, or will they?
No, they will not be able to. No.
Okay.
The case will have to have been opened after the law takes effect.
Well, are there other challenges that CLERB has faced when investigating in custody deaths?
Well, jails are complicated systems, and I think CLERB not having the full picture of what happened to a person makes it really, really difficult. I mean, jails are, Sheriff Kelly Martinez brought this up at yesterday's board meeting. You know, a jail is not designed to be a hospital, yet many incarcerated people are in poor health. Jails aren't designed to be mental health facilities, but around 30 to 40% of San Diego's jail population is on psychiatric meds, and people die from all sorts of causes. And so I think the big challenge for getting a full picture of how someone died and what steps, what could be done, policy changes, other changes, to help prevent deaths in the future, I think for oversight to be able to get the full picture, it is really important.
And you know, we already know a lot, but remind us what CLIRB does and what they're responsible for, like what other cases they investigate.
So when they were created, it was to investigate any allegations of misconduct or policy violations by county law enforcement. So that would be sheriff's deputies and probation officers. And so they have, there's a citizens board, but there are also professional investigators who are county employees, but work on CLIRB's behalf. And so they go in and they investigate these cases. For almost all of these are complaint-based. But when someone dies in custody, that is an automatic, that is something that CLIRB will automatically investigate. And they've added some other things in. If someone suffers a great bodily injury at the hands of a deputy or probation officer, that is now investigated. If a deputy discharges a weapon, that is investigated. So they've kind of had their jurisdiction like slowly expanded over the years to include, a lot more actions by law enforcement that folks might have questions about.
All right. So then getting back to this vote, the Sheriff's Department, they opposed the idea of expanding CLIRB's authority. What did they say?
So the sheriff has submitted a couple memos ahead of the vote, and basically arguing that this will have a chilling effect on jail medical services. The jail currently contracts out for medical services, and she's indicated that the contractors, it's NAFCARE, which is a huge nationwide, they provide medical services in lots of jails. And then there's a smaller contractor that's locally based, and they provide the nurses and the psychiatrists and nurse practitioners and such. And so she's indicated they're not too happy with this form of oversight. And she's really questioned CLIRB's ability to understand medical services in jails and to investigate medical staff. But what I think is important to mention, and this kind of keeps getting left out, is CLIRB's not just gonna, dive into this with its existing staff. They will be hiring two additional investigators, and then they will be bringing in, and they have funding for this, they will be bringing in outside medical experts to review cases. So these won't be lay people trying to figure out if a medical professional made a mistake. It will be actual medical professionals kind of reviewing the actions of jail medical staff.
I mean, people have died here. So if not having CLIRB look into this, I mean, did the sheriff propose any alternatives or other solutions?
Yeah, so she proposed what she called she wanted to see these were her words yesterday, an independent and comprehensive assessment of the quality and effectiveness of healthcare services delivered within the jail system. But that wasn't what was on the agenda yesterday. It's good to hear the Sheriff's Department asking for such a thing, because there have been lots of lawsuits. There have been lots of investigations by other entities that the sheriff has pushed back on. There was a state audit. There have been a couple advocacy groups that have done their own investigations, and the sheriff's department has pushed back on those. So for the sheriff to go to the Board of Supervisors and request an independent comprehensive assessment of healthcare services within the jail, I think that's something that the board should take her up on.
Are you surprised about the timing of this ask?
Kind of, just given, I've been covering this for a decade, and I have seen how much time other, Disability Rights California, we've got a class action lawsuit against the jails that they've brought in a lot of outside experts. The state auditor put together a pretty scathing, comprehensive review of jail deaths in San Diego, finding that the county had the largest highest mortality rate among California's large counties, large jail systems. That audit was completed in early 2022, and that should have, I'm surprised that that wasn't the moment when the sheriff said, "Hey, okay, like we don't agree with everything in this audit, but hey, let's bring in county. Like, why don't you do your own assessment of how we're doing, and go from there. See what we can do from there." People continue to die. There were two pretty horrific deaths in July that we know about. We know the details of only because of this class action lawsuit, and their attorneys were able to go in and get sworn declarations from men who were in cells nearby the two guys that died. These were separate instances, but both shared a lot of really troubling things in common about that just suggested neglect, lack of responsiveness to medical need, and real real serious questions about how folks with cognitive challenges or mental illness, how they are cared for in jails.
Well, so far this year, 8 people have died in San Diego County jails, and you mentioned the gruesome deaths of 2 men in custody, which you reported on. How would you describe the state of jail conditions now?
The sheriff, they say they're doing everything. They're the folks that they house are people that don't always get regular health care. Folks who are homeless, folks who've got. Have had long time struggles with substance use addiction or substance use disorder or mental health. So it's a very challenging population. I think the sheriff's office has been very reactive. Only after a record number of suicides did the sheriff's office bring in an outside expert. Only after several overdose deaths did deputies start carrying Narcan, the drug that reverses opioid overdoses. The sheriff did mention yesterday that she wants to start focusing on prevention. And so hopefully that's something that she'll continue to push for, and they'll be able to get ahead of future deaths, and we won't see record numbers like we've seen in past years.
When we look at the jail conditions, you recently reported that the sheriff is phasing out triple bunking in jails. They've done this since 2016, despite state regulators repeatedly telling them to halt the practice. So how does triple bunking contribute to, these conditions?
Well, on Monday, I attended the sentencing of a young man who was in an acute state of mental illness and was put in a triple bunk cell with another man who was in an acute state of mental illness. And then there was a third man in there with them, tiny, I think it's 75 square feet, tiny, tiny cells that I think any normal person would really struggle with being stuck in that sort of situation with two other people. And the two men, they ended up fighting. One of them beat the other guy so severely, he ended up in a coma and eventually ended up on life support, and his family had to withdraw care. And so that young man was sentenced to 12 years in jail on Monday. And he was, and this was a theme in the sentencing, his family was there, family members of the man who died made statements that they were really put in a situation that kind of created the environment for violence. They should have been, it should have been recognized that both these people were acutely psychotic. They had history of violent crimes. Like, let's not put them in the same cell together, maybe separate them for a time so they could cool off. But instead, that wasn't considered. And you had 3 people in a cell, and it just created a very, very dangerous situation. And we've seen this happen before. So yeah, the sheriff's department says they're phasing out triple bunking, but I've heard that it's still happening. So I just hope, you know, state regulators have been on them almost every year to telling them to stop, and they say that they're working on it. So yeah, that's definitely something I'll keep following.
Well, you know, CLRB itself has seen some upheaval over the years, with leadership changing due to frustration over what former executive officer Paul Parker says is a lack of progress and support from supervisors. What were the issues there? I mean, did CLRB not have enough authority or teeth?
For a long time, CLRB was very under-resourced and I think not taken seriously, and maybe for good reason. You know, not a lot of people attended their meetings and the reports that they put out weren't very thorough. But now they have a solid team of investigators. There are people who show up to every meeting urging them to investigate. You know, families after a loved one has died will show up to CLRB meetings and say, please look into my daughter's death, look into my son's death, don't forget how my daughter died, and let's make sure that that doesn't happen again. You know, counties have, and San Diego County, they have lots of boards and commissions. So many of them are equally as important, but I think due to the number of lawsuits we've seen and the amount of money that have gone to lawsuit settlements, tens of millions of dollars, I think the Board of Supervisors is starting to pay attention. I think when Paul Parker resigned, the message he sent, that he felt like he was kind of hitting his head against a brick wall all the time, I think that was heard by supervisors. And this step to give CLRB more authority, more jurisdiction, was a response to that. So I think they are getting attention from supervisors. Hopefully that will, you know, that will lead to, you know, it's really the only, it's really the best form of transparency that we have. You know, where findings in deaths or misconduct investigations are made as public as possible. And that doesn't exist anywhere else, really.
Yeah. Well, you know, before we go, what are you following next?
The sheriff asking for an independent analysis of jail medical mental health services. No sheriff has requested such a thing from the county before. And I hope they take her up on that. I hope they move ahead with that. And I hope that that process is transparent from start to finish. Who they select, how they go about selecting that person, and then the full analysis. What are the findings? You know, what kind of report will be made publicly available? I think that should be something that the board sees through, and I hope the sheriff will continue to push for that, and also understand the importance of transparency.
All right. Well, I've been speaking with Kelly Davis, investigative reporter with the San Diego Union-Tribune. Kelly, as always, thanks for your reporting and thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much, Jade.
Coming up next, everyone loves avocados, but producing them is a challenge in San Diego. Hear more when KPBS Midday Edition returns.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Paint Care, offering households and businesses in California more than 800 leftover paint drop-off sites for recycling. Quantities of 100-plus gallons of paint may qualify for a large volume pickup. Learn more at paintcare.org.
Welcome back to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. Across the globe, avocado production is up. The countries of Morocco, Brazil, and even Nigeria are trying to cash in on the demand for this beloved fruit. But here in San Diego County, long one of the largest producers of avocados in the world, fewer and fewer are being grown. KPBS reporter John Carroll joins me live to talk about his latest reporting. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jade. Good to be here.
Good to have you in studio. I'd like to start by talking about Jennifer Bantley. She's an avocado farmer in Fallbrook you talked to. Tell me about her and what she shared.
So she and her husband, Kurt, started their farm in Fallbrook in 2011. They were very excited about it, you know, just gung-ho and everything. And the first thing they found out was that they were going to have to, what they call stump, which is chop down, basically, a lot of their trees and basically start over. Because the trees were too big, they were too old. There's a lot of different reasons on that. So that was a rude awakening right away. Mm-hmm. But they stuck with it, and she is very proud of what she does. She says she has the best avocados in San Diego County. I'm sure a lot of the growers say that. And so they got going with one hand tied behind their back, basically, because you don't just put in new trees and voila, they produce fruit. It takes them years to grow and get to that point. So it's been tough. I know we'll talk a little more later about what they're doing now, but Kurt had to keep his job as a wireless engineer to be able to continue to afford to be able to farm. But they're sticking with it for now. It's a rough go for them.
And so this is a random question because you mentioned the trees just getting too old. Once the trees start producing, what's their lifespan like?
You know, I would love to tell you that.
Yeah.
I do not know. I know that I've been to several of the farms, and there are a lot of farms where the trees have been there for decades, I can tell you that.
Yeah.
But I don't know precisely.
Yeah. And I can only imagine once you have to cut it down again, it's years before they start producing after being planted.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so why are avocados then such an expensive crop to grow?
Well, it really, for the most part, comes down to water. Water has done nothing but get more expensive over the last couple of decades. All of us in San Diego County know that because of our home water bill. Farmers in the county are eligible for an agricultural discount, which helps, but it is still tremendously expensive. I wasn't aware on a granular level of how expensive it was until I talked to some of the farmers, and this fact really blew me away, that an average avocado, just one piece of fruit, not the whole tree, mm-hmm. takes 70 to 80 gallons of water to grow. So, you know, you think the average tree is producing hundreds of pieces of fruit, so you can do the math. It takes a lot of water. And the Bantleys... In 2019, they paid $4.42 per 1,000 gallons. That would be with the agricultural water rate. The agricultural water rate in Fallbrook Public Utility District now is $5.83 per 1,000 gallons. So it's just a real struggle for the farmers, all of them, with the cost of water.
It's incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
Well, so what happens to all those trees when the cost of water is just too high?
So they either stump them, or they just stop watering them. That's why the total acreage planted in the county has really sunk by tens of thousands of acres over the last however many years.
Well, given the cost of water, is it worth it to farmers to even grow them?
That's sort of, you know, the big question. That answer is different for every one of them. Mm-hmm. It depends on what their acreage is, how their trees are doing, how much fruit is coming in from Mexico, which is a big thing right now. They bring in much more fruit than California and San Diego County produce, and that drives down the cost.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, you know, that answer probably varies as time goes by and the situation changes, and you'd say, okay, it's now such that I feel like I can get into it, or not.
Yeah. Well, talk to me about the emotional toll of all this on people like Jennifer.
Jennifer is a really good soul. She considers her trees to be her friends. I mean, she talks to them. She loves them. She takes care of them like children. She became emotional during our interview. There's a lot of stuff that is challenging for them right now. I mean, the fact that her husband still has to do his regular job while working on the farm when he can. But I did talk to her about it, and I know we have a little sound from her right now.
It's really depressing. So I get really emotional about this because I'm so, like, involved with my farm. And I am the one doing a lot of the work. I am the one pruning the trees. I am the one throwing the wood. I'm a 2-time cancer survivor. And I have a lot of years, my good years, that have been put into this.
Wow.
Yeah.
It weighs so heavy.
It does. And I mean, you're there every day. The trees are there. And it's just really hard.
Yeah. Well, another big part of this is, you know, the H-2A visa program. What are some barriers to qualifying for that?
Well, it has to do with acreage. Some of the smaller farms do not qualify. But if you can qualify, it's a really great thing because you can bring in workers from out of the country. They are under the H-2A visa, which means it's legal for them to work here. So there are a lot of factors and qualifications. I would urge the audience, if they're interested, to Google H-2A visa program. It's a lot more than I have time to go into now, but there are just a lot of different issues related to that, and it's just gotten harder now with the crackdowns on immigration as well.
Well, exactly. That leads me to my next question. I mean, it's just one of the issues relating to labor, and how are those immigration policies under Trump affecting the agricultural industry?
So I talked to Jennifer about that and to some of the other farmers and a farm manager. First of all, with Jennifer, she told me something that is kind of scary, actually. She said that she has seen when she's been on the farm, she's seen helicopters buzzing around, quite obviously looking down at her farm. So, I mean, what would they be doing there? She said that that she has had to be coached in what to say when immigration folks show up. So that is a very tough thing for them. Then a manager of a place called ACA Groves, a very large farm, hundreds of acres, his name is Serafin Michel. He has worked there for 50 plus years since he was a teenager. So he knows, like, the business. He knows all the people at the surrounding farms. So he has his ear to the ground, as it were, on this. I talked to him about what's going on as far as trying to hire workers, because you can grow the best fruit in the world and have a ton of it, but if there's no one to pick it, you know, obviously not good. So I think we have a little clip from Serafin here talking about that very issue.
A lot of my neighbors are dropping the fruit because there ain't no local workers. See, most of the big ranches around this area is gone because of the water prices. It's killing us. The laborers is killing us. The avocados from Mexico and Peru and all these other places, they ship in avocados to the United States, they drop our price down. We have no chance to survive. And now with the labor, it's even worse.
And so now Jennifer Bantley's family is entering into a county program called PACE.
Right.
So what does that stand for and what does it do?
It stands for Purchase of Agricultural Conservation Easement. So that's a mouthful. Mm-hmm. What it means is that the county, in the interest of not having urban sprawl all over the place, pays farmers to not develop their land, to keep it for agricultural use only. So there's a certain amount of money, and I'm sorry, I can't remember exactly what it is, that they pay per acre. It's a varying amount depending on the whys and the wherefores of a particular farm. So Jennifer and her husband are going into it, and that will help them. I think they're moving toward just not growing avocados anymore because it's just so challenging with the water especially. They're going to concentrate. Last time I talked to her, she said they're going to concentrate more on their vineyard, going in the wine direction.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Well, yeah. Yeah. With tariffs, I guess, you know, that would be a good place to go.
Right. You're just, a lot of people love California wine.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, so what are the county's long-term goals with this program, PACE?
So they are talking about getting 443, to be precise, acres set aside every year. Since it's been going, they have preserved more than 3,000 acres. So, you know, it's not for everybody, but for those who just have tried and just are tired of fighting the battle, it's a way to go for them. One thing, though, Jennifer told me, is that it does affect resale value of their land if they're in that program. You know, who would want to buy it necessarily and be under those strictures? Mm-hmm. So it's not, you know, the answer to all prayers. Yeah.
Right. Well, hopefully the incentive is there for them.
Right.
I mean, the story doesn't exactly end here, right? I mean, what else are you following next?
So we are going to air the story about Jennifer and her farm and all of that on Thursday, tomorrow. And then there is going to be another part of this story, which has more to do with a lawsuit that a group of growers have brought against the major importer packing companies, which are Del Monte Fresh, Calavo, and Mission Produce. They say that those companies are misrepresenting the Mexican product that comes into this country as sustainably grown, that there is no environmental damage caused in Mexico to grow the fruit. And they say that's not true. There's a lot of clear cutting, which, you know, obviously not good for the earth. And so they have brought this class action suit. There's a group of them. And that's working its way through the courts right now. So we'll be talking about that in the following story after the one on the Bantleys.
All right. I tell you, avocados weren't really on my radar, but I am so invested in this reporting now, John.
It's really interesting. I had no idea what I was getting into when I started doing this story, and I'm like, what have you done? But there's other interesting stuff going on. There's a grower named Norm Kachuk who is trying to develop a different variety. The Haas is what we're all mainly familiar with.
Sure.
But trying to develop another variety called the Reed avocado, which is much larger.
Okay.
It is very, very creamy and delicious. But it doesn't have the characteristics that the Haas has had sort of bred into it, where it can withstand being shipped and handled and getting it to the store and it's still, you know.
Right, intact.
Intact, right. And so he's working with some biogeneticists to try and manipulate it to the point where it can be like the Haas in that sense. And part of the reason for that is they don't have much, if any, reed avocados grown in Mexico. And so this would be a way for U.S. growers, Californians, to have something that they don't have and a new market.
Wow.
So,
well,
lot to it.
I see. We'll keep our eyes and ears open for more reporting on that, John.
Yes. Let the guacamole rain, Jade.
Oh, there we go. I've been speaking with John Carroll. He's a general assignment reporter and anchor at KPBS. John, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jade.
Still to come, the history of a beloved mountain in San Diego County when KPBS Midday Edition returns.
From El Centro to everywhere, we're Voices del Valle.
Voices del Valle?
Voices del Valle is a teen-produced podcast about coming of age in California's Imperial Valley.
I love Voices del Valle.
On the next episode of Voices del Valle, we will talk with teens that moved to the Imperial Valley and what they discovered.
I've got to listen to that. Voices del Valle, fresh voices, bold stories made in the valley.
Voices del Valle. Find us on KPBS or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. Cowles Mountain, as I call it, is not just San Diego's highest peak. It's a beloved spot cherished by hikers and nature loves across the nation and across the region, really. But it wouldn't be the landmark it is today without the efforts of community leaders 50 years ago to preserve it, making it the largest urban park in California. I'm joined now by San Diego Union-Tribune reporter David Garrick. David, welcome to Midday Edition.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, I'm so glad you're here. Is it Cowles or Cowles?
Well, officially, it has to be Cowles because it's the name of a family and we can't really change their name. But I know everyone I know refers to it as Cowles, and I still, you know, accidentally refer to it as Cowles frequently and think of it that way. That's how I came to know it. So it's a tough situation, I guess.
It is. I wonder how it became Cowles instead of Cowles.
I just think this. I think the word cow, I mean, just jumps out. You see C-O-W, and I think people, I think that's my theory. And I don't think people remember George Cowles, who, you know, founded the city of Santee and owned that land, because it was, you know, so many years ago, he's not a familiar name. So no one really knows his name was Cowles.
I see. Well, I'm glad we've cleared that up.
Well, one thing that's interesting, yeah. I wrote a story recently about these folks who led the charge to buy the land. And they admitted to me in the story that when they bought it, they thought it was pronounced Cowles. So they bought it without knowing the right name. So that maybe makes us feel a little bit better about our errors.
It really does. Well, you know, so the idea then to preserve and purchase Cowles or Cowles came at a time when development in the East County was really picking up. Was that the main reason for the purchase by San Diego?
I think it was. I think that the fact that there was sprawl happening in Allied Gardens and Del Cerro and San Carlos and those neighborhoods, and that there wasn't a lot of open space and people didn't know how far the development was going to go, there was this idea that we should preserve some of the open spaces that we do have. I think it was also coincidence at the same time you had the environmental movement was being born. The first Earth Day was in 1970, and they bought Cowles in 1974. So, you know, that was a new idea. And you also had increased consciousness about indigenous communities, and there are a lot of Kumeyaay sites in that area. So there's a lot of things were working together simultaneously to create sort of a perfect storm to make this kind of thing happen.
Yeah, it's great that there was that effort to preserve that. You write that the purchase may not have happened if it weren't for the efforts of one community volunteer, and that's Dorothy Leonard, and also a plane ride that happened. So tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, Dorothy was a PTA leader, a typical, you know, story you would think. Then she got involved in a local planning group. She became aware of all the situation with the development. And she tried to lobby people to preserve this land. And she got some county and city officials and some other officials into a plane at Gillespie Field. It took off from Gillespie Field in El Cajon. And they flew over the land. And she thinks that may have done the trick. She overheard them saying, "We've got to preserve this. We've got to preserve this." So it could have been just getting a bird's eye view of the entire area really flipped the switch and made people realize it was time to preserve this land by buying it.
So aside from that bit, tell me about the history of Cowles Mountain.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was known as S Mountain because San Diego State students used to paint an S on it for homecoming every year. It did not have a trailhead. So if there were hikers, they were really ambitious hikers. So we don't know how many people hiked it back in the day. And when the city bought it, it didn't really have a trailhead. So it really was not what it came to be at the time the city bought it. I don't think it was like, oh, we're going to buy the most popular hiking trail in the region. Because they bought it and preserved it, it slowly became what's arguably the most popular hiking trail in the region. And it's what people know today. The view is remarkable, and it's iconic, really. It's become known as one of San Diego's most beloved places.
Well, as you mentioned, the purchase of Cowles was really the beginning of a much larger effort to incorporate other public land in the area, something Leonard called a perfect storm, as you say. Tell us about how areas like Lake Murray became a part of the greater vision.
Yeah, well, that's another reason why Cowles is such an important move, because when the city bought it, instead of thinking at the time the county had a plan where Lake Murray might be a regional park, and Fortuna Mountain, which the federal government had given to the city, might be a regional park. When they bought Cowles And they thought of the idea, hey, maybe we could combine Coles and Mission Gorge and Lake Murray and Fortuna and create one giant regional park, which, as we know today, is Mission Trails Regional Park. But if they hadn't bought Coles, arguably maybe they wouldn't have thought of that grand plan.
Wow. Well, one challenge leaders struggled with was what to call this greater park. How did Mission Trails Regional Park become the name?
As far as I understand it, they did a contest and people put in names, and someone was smart enough to think about, well, there's a mission, the Mission Gorge, and there are trails. And, you know, I don't know who that person is. I believe they don't get full credit, but whoever they are, if they're out there listening, you made a big difference in San Diego history.
Yeah.
One other thing to mention is that another piece of luck is that because there was not enough parkland in the suburbs, eastern suburbs at that time, and in other parts of San Diego, the voters approved in 1977 Proposition C, which was a bond to buy land for parks. But at the time, the thought was these would be neighborhood parks in neighborhoods like Rancho Bernardo and La Jolla and Point Loma. But some city leaders had the vision to say, let's use that money to buy land to increase the size of Mission Trails Regional Park and fill in the gaps. So that was another fluky thing that happened to come at just the right time to help create this giant park that we all cherish.
Hmm. You spoke to a number of officials who worked on this project over the years, including former San Diego Mayor Dick Murphy. What did you take away from their reflections on what the park has become?
That they were extremely proud. Murphy told me it was the most important thing he did while he was a city councilman. And also they were willing to be very humble and say, we would love to pretend at the time that we knew we were visionaries, but they didn't know how big a deal it was at the time. They feel lucky that it turned out to be such a big deal. They were trying to do one smart thing and not do something maybe as ambitious as what it turned out to be.
Hmm. Well, and maybe as a testament to how beloved the park is, you write, Coles draws about 1 million hikers per year. So are there any concerns about how to preserve Coles or Coles for its next 50 years?
Yeah, well, maybe 6, 7, 8 years ago, they did something called the 5-Hike Challenge, which was a challenge to hikers to hike all 5 peaks that are in Mission Trails Regional Park. And while the goal was to get people to do that, it was also to get people off of Coles or Coles, because it is so popular that the thought was, let's get people hiking in all the areas instead of this one famous trail. The reason that Coles remains the most famous is, though, just the view is breathtaking. You can see Coronado, you can see Point Loma. On clear days, you can see Catalina. So that will still always probably be number one. But as a testament to how popular, almost too popular it's become, they did create something called the 5-Hike Challenge to pull people off of Coles.
Mm, and tell me again, like, you know, just for people who may not be familiar with it, what is the 5-Peak Challenge?
It's North Fortuna. There's 2 Fortunas, and there's Coles, and then there's I can't think of it. It's Ipay. I don't know. People can look it up. I apologize. I don't know the last two.
Hmm. All right. All right. We're going to find out. But, you know, as far as Coles Mountain is concerned, I mean, you know, people use it to hike, but people do a lot more than just hike over there in that area. I mean, I know that when there's a full moon, there's a group of folks who hike to the top to just meditate. Can you talk about some of the other things people do at Coles and how much it means to folks?
No, I mean, it's cherished. That I'm always jealous when I see people running up Coles, which I don't see how you can possibly do that. But no, there are night hikes. There's a lot. Mission Trails Regional Park has really become, a jewel for San Diego. And there's a lot of things that go on there just beyond hiking for sure.
Oh, yeah. Well, I got to ask, have you done the Coles Mountain hike yourself?
I have many times, yeah, and before I even knew it was 50 years old or any of this history. So this is a fun story for me to write because it's sort of a place that I love to go, and I learned so many things that I had no idea about until I did the reporting.
Yeah, it's next on my list, I tell you.
All right.
You know, I think San Diego has really a long history of navigating development, and it's one you still cover in your beat today. What did you take away about that in telling this story on Coles?
I think the coincidences and the luck. I mean, I think everyone tries to look at stories from a perspective of simple or visionary. And just speaking to Larry Sterling, who was a city councilman during some of the key moments, he just kept stressing that this was just so lucky that so many things came together just at the right time. Land from the federal government that was near other land, that was an army base. you know, so many things happen right around the same time. And you know, really, a lot of the successes we've had in San Diego and other parts of the country, a lot of times are mostly luck sometimes.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is a part of San Diego that a lot of people don't get to hear about. So many thanks for sharing in your reporting. David Garrick covers City Hall for the San Diego Union-Tribune. David, again, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. Thanks for tuning in to Midday Edition. Be sure to have a great day on purpose, everyone.
Start your day with Morning Edition and wind it down with All Things Considered. Only on KPBS. From global headlines to local stories, stay informed, inspired, and connected. Tune in daily or listen anytime at kpbs.org.